Guitarathon is the greatest guitar sale on earth, and it's happening now. Get massive savings on a huge selection of electric and acoustic guitars, basses, amps, pedals, and other accessories. Get select Ernie Ball strings, 3 for $10. Save $100 on a Fender Special Edition Strat, or get a Yamaha acoustic for just $199. Plus, get special financing on select major brands. Don't miss these incredible deals. Available online and in-store, now through November 1st. Guitarathon, only at Guitar Center. Find your sound.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, let's do this. Welcome to Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. My name is Wes Goldberg. I'm the editor at AllYouCanHeat.com and the host of this fine program. With me on the other line, it's David Ramil. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, man. I mean, despite the 1-2 record for the Miami Heat, I think there have been some encouraging signs there, and we get a chance to talk about them now, thanks to our wonderful Mailbag Monday on Tuesday.
Transmissions Tuesday. Let's just get right into it. And that's exactly where we're going to start is Marcus Bonaparte's question. There's no way that's your real name, Marcus. Like, that's too good of a name to be a real name.
Marcus Bonaparte, Napoleon's distant cousin? A Heat fan? That's awesome. Yeah.
Lucky us. So Marcus writes, this is the most excited I've for an NBA regular season in a long time that I've been in a long time. I know it's only been two games, but the Heat look good even without Josh Richardson. Being up 18 and losing isn't great, but not too bad of a loss this early in the season. I think he's talking about the Charlotte game.
Right.
I saw more positives than negatives. Am I being too much of a homer? Did you guys see anything concerning that proves there's no way for the Heat to make the playoffs this season?
A lot going on there. Obviously, he didn't get a chance to see Sunday night's performance against the Spurs, and although that did wind up in a loss, there were some encouraging signs from that one as well.
I think he sent this email before the Spurs game, so maybe he didn't watch it. But yeah, the question is there at the very end. Did you guys see anything concerning that proves there's no way for the Heat to make the playoffs? This is, to me, sounds like an innocent till proven guilty type deal where it's only been three games, and no, I haven't seen anything to say that the Heat aren't going to make the playoffs. But before the season, I didn't expect the Heat to make the playoffs. I know that's where a lot of Heat fans differ in their opinion of what this team can be. For me, I just don't see this team being a playoff team, but a lot of Heat fans did think that this team could fight for the playoffs.
And I think that's the barometer by which they measure this team's success. And I think we've seen some activity as far as Twitter and Heat Twitter in particular saying, look, as long as this team continues to develop and show progress this year and incorporate their younger players and build on that, that's still a successful one. But I think a lot more players, not necessarily a lot more fans necessarily plugged into the team from that perspective, maybe not as a writing perspective or from a developmental standpoint, see playoffs or bust as the measure of success for this team. And that just might not be the best barometer. I think it's time to kind of, hedge a little bit of those expectations and look at this team growing from the inside, knowing that the draft isn't necessarily an option to build off, that we might not necessarily be able to add a big free agent here and there without, a player like Dwayne Wade or Chris Bosh or anybody else on the roster. So at this point, it's more about continuing to get better and looking forward to this season and beyond that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and you look at that giving up, what was it, 19 points, I think, to Charlotte.
Yeah.
And then being right in there at the end of the Spurs game until Kawhi Leonard just went off. And losing it kind of towards the end of that game. I don't think that those are going to be exceptions to the rule. I think that's just what you get when you have such a young team. There was a stat out there about last year's Timberwolves team that had leads going into the last 5 minutes of so many games and ended up losing most of those games.
Right.
That's just what happens to young teams, that don't necessarily have closers, so to speak. I mean, with Dwayne Wade gone, they don't have that guy that you could just give the ball to and get hit a mid-range 16-footer to seal the game. You know what I mean? It's not – they're still looking for that, but they're still looking for a lot of things. I mean, crisp passing without turning the ball over in the last few minutes, that's important. But that's the thing that young teams do. So not – being careful about when you're being aggressive as a young player so that you're not picking up your fourth or fifth foul with plenty of time still left to go in the game, which we've seen with Hassan Whiteside and Justice Winslow even already this season. These are going to be trends as we go through this year. So to me, I will view this team really in the first three quarters. I think that's really where you want to kind of maybe draw a conclusion from just how good this team could be, even if it's not is that good, because the veteran teams and the really good teams, just like we saw during the Big Three Heat, people used to always complain that they would just kind of, you know, coast through the first three quarters and then turn it on the fourth. Well, that's exactly what they did. They just kept it close, knowing that all they had to do is turn it on the fourth because they could do that. The Heat don't have that luxury. They're going to try really, really hard for the entire 48 minutes, but those first three quarters against veteran teams and better teams, they'll be able to keep it close until those teams start to take it away in the fourth quarter. That's just the way the NBA works.
Yeah, you know, you've been on top of that from the beginning, you know, questioning who would be the team's closer, and I think you've shown very prescience over the last few games and seeing that we've, you know, either blown leads like we did against Charlotte or not had somebody to match Leonard's production late in the fourth quarter. So I think that's going to be a recurring theme there, and that's probably what we'll feel Wade's absence most sharply, right? I mean, I guess that goes without saying. You know, we were seeing positives, and we have seen through the preseason and through the first three games of the year that there is a much quicker tempo, and that would say, you know, a lot of people would say, and I've been one of them to say, you know, without Wade there, it looks like this team is going to be better moving forward. And yeah, that might be the case from that perspective, but as far as the last few minutes of the game, you definitely need somebody who's willing to take those big shots, able to get the foul call. Look, Leonard, you know, didn't hit every shot he took in the fourth quarter, but he got to the line on a number of occasions because he got that superstar call, and that's somebody that we don't have that person on Miami's roster, so look to that being an issue throughout the year, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, Goran Dragic at 30 years old, he probably should be the guy, and he tried to be that guy towards the end. He hit a few clutch buckets there at the end of that Spurs game and has been playing well for the first three games so far. I think he can be that, but he's still getting used to his new role in Miami. He's still getting used to being with a bunch of much younger players in that starting unit or on that team just basically in general. I think this team's also probably approached the season with thinking Chris Bosh was going to be that guy, and he's not there either, so that's worth mentioning. But to answer Marcus's question back to that, is there anything concerning that proves that there's no way that he can make the playoffs? No, I don't think that there's anything that stuck out to me saying, like, okay, this there's no way that the Heat are going to make the playoffs. But again, I didn't think that they were going to make it in the first place. Right. And none of this is bad. Like, none of this is, like, what we're talking about right now. None of that's bad stuff. That's stuff that we have expected. This is the third, we're going after the third game of the season, going into our fourth game of the season. This team's going to get better. Maybe somebody does emerge. Maybe Justice Winslow does start shooting better. I thought Winslow particularly did a really good job starting to figure out that he needed to drive to the rim and be more aggressive. And I think he's gotten better at that in each game as each game has gone on. Maybe that becomes a theme throughout this season. But anything else on that before we move on to our next question?
No, I think you wrapped it up pretty nicely.
So, Sean Dugan, with our next question. How much longer is Josh Richardson going to be out? Short and sweet question. Thanks, Sean. So, Richardson, the report of Richardson's MCL tear was on September 9th. The typical recovery for an MCL tear is 4 to 6 weeks. So far, it's been about 7 weeks. Referring back to when this first happened, you and I talked about it. 4 to 6 weeks would be, you know, best case scenario. Sometimes this goes longer. Sometimes it goes shorter. You know, I think, didn't, like, Meta World Peace tear his MCL and, like, came back within, like, 2 weeks once? Like, it was crazy.
He's a freak of nature, though. I don't know if that's...
It's insane.
So, I don't know if we want to use that as the measure by which
anybody
else... His MCL is
probably still torn. He just played anyway. But, yeah, I mean, 4 to 6 weeks, but going, like, through training camp, preseason, and three games now into the regular season, there's not going to be a rush necessarily to bring Josh Richardson back, just because this team doesn't have championship goals. Like, they're very realistic. This team isn't going to the Eastern Conference Finals anytime, like, this season. There's no reason to, and it's the very beginning of the season, there's no reason to rush Richardson back. So he was in his street clothes on the bench in all these games so far. I don't see them rushing him back. If I had to guess, I'd say maybe next week. Does that sound right?
Yeah, there's a bit of a gap there in between the... Well, no, actually, that's this week, isn't it? The upcoming Kings game and well, let's see, the Thunder play next week, and then there's a gap between that, and then when Dwayne Wade comes to town along with the Chicago Bulls. And I think that might be the best time to see him out there. And that would be interesting to see if Richardson comes back and starts and plays against his former mentor and Wade. That would be an interesting matchup there. But I don't know. On the flip side of that, I think I've seen some of your more paranoid fans talk about that maybe holding Richardson out is part of a longer-term maybe slight tanking process. Do you give any credence to that? Because I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I'm more in line with your way of thinking that, you know, he just doesn't need to be rushed back necessarily, and that once he comes back, he'll be at full strength and he'll be ready to go. And then that's when Spoelstra can change a lot of his lineups around. And, you know, he also does need practice time. I'm sure he's been practicing somewhat with the team, if not going through full contact at this point. And I think for Spoelstra's benefit, you know, he needs to see who he can get out there. And, you know, at what time, what kind of rotation, you know, works best and things of that sort. So I think they're trying to ease that process back rather than just thrusting in a guy who's going to be a big part of your development plans moving forward and kind of rushing him into a situation where his health or his development in any way might be hindered.
If this was late in the season or even the playoffs, you know, I think sure. If he's 70%, you just put him in there. If he's 80% during the regular season, he's probably in there. Just at any like regular middle of the, you know, December, January type regular season game. But it's the beginning of the year. You want him to be like 110% by the time he gets in there. There's, because there's, again, no reason to rush him back. So that's all I think it is. That's all I think it is.
Have you seen the change of style from Richardson on the sidelines there?
That navy blue suit with the tie clip looking very sharp.
I even caught Derek Williams pointing out the clip to him once, like kind of pointing at it, and Richardson kind of looking down at it like, oh, thanks for noticing. And he even tweeted something out about that feeling when you finally start to dress like an adult, I guess not wear jorts anymore. I mean, that's, you know, Richardson's coming into his own this season. I guess he's finally maturing somewhat, even if it's just in his style of dress. But it's, I guess, a positive step.
I want to believe that he still has jorts on underneath the suit.
That would be weird.
What's that? Arrested Development? What's his
Tobias
name?
Tobias Fünke?
Yeah, Tobias Fünke style. Just always wears the jorts.
That'd be great. I never knew. I don't think Richardson's a never nude. In fact, I'm sure I've seen him with just a towel in the locker room. Although, again, maybe the jorts were under the towel. That's a question I don't want to ask, and I never will find out the answer to.
I think Josh is a never nude.
Putting that out there?
This is my reality, okay? I live in my own reality, and that's what I'm going to believe.
Wow.
So, I don't remember what we were talking about. Josh Richardson, never nude, jorts, injury, MCL tear. I think we covered all of it.
Right. I mean, at this point, nothing official from the team. They're somewhat mum about it. You know, like we saw with Josh McRoberts, one day he's inactive, the other day he's active. He just didn't play. We're going to find out about this the day before. Look, I saw it up close. You know, I saw it, the kind of tight-lipped approach that Spoelstra has, where they were trying to ask him before opening night against the Magic who his starting lineup was. This was at shoot around hours before tip-off. And they're like, and Spoelstra, this is answering questions from the big guns, I.R. Winderman, Jason Jackson, all these other guys, not to mention a scrub like me. And they asked him, you know, what the starting lineup was. He's like, oh, you don't need to know that. We'll find out sooner or later. Like, he's telling him, no, I'm not going to give you that information. And then afterwards, the reporters were all joking about it. Like, I can't believe you went in there and tried to find out about this. So this is clearly an established thing with this organization, is that they just don't release that kind of information needlessly. And so I'm sure we'll find out about it when it happens, as he's ready to play again, but not a moment sooner.
All right, our next question comes from Brian Young. If Justice Winslow's ceiling is a playmaking version of Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, is that a disappointment? Not a bad comparison, considering that MKG's hat is hung on his perimeter defense, right?
Right.
So just got a couple stats here pulled up, because when we talk about Justice Winslow and comparing him to defensive first small forward types, we automatically also look at their three-point shooting. So let's just look at that really quick. In his first season, MKG shot 22.2% from three-point range, which is actually worse than Justice Winslow's 27.6% his rookie year. And I think Draymond Green also shot just like 20% from three-point range his first year. We compare Winslow to Draymond a lot, even though Draymond was coming off the bench and wasn't nearly as used as much as guys like MKG or even Justice Winslow his first season. But
I'm also looking at these attempts, though. Not you know, total attempts for the season, but he averaged just 0.1 attempts from long range. So I think he's a guy who's always acknowledged that he has shooting problems, and it's been well documented that he's gone through a rebuilt shooting mechanism. So I don't think it's nearly as disastrous a shooting stroke as Winslow's.
It was disastrous. I mean, we've seen pictures of MKG's shooting.
I'm sorry, yeah, I meant it the other way around. Winslow's shooting stroke has never been as disastrous as MKG's.
That's a really good point. Yeah, you're right. Looking at these attempts now, Kid Gilchrist has never averaged more than one attempt per game from 3-point range. So he's basically just written off that part of the game completely. Even this year, he's not shooting them. So. Winslow's at least trying. He's shot 1.5 attempts per game his rookie year, and now up to 3.7 through three games this season. So he's trying. So I like that. So size-wise, defensive-wise, they're similar. I wouldn't say that. To me, MKG is more of a... He might be more of like a Tony Allen.
Yeah.
If Winslow's more on the Jimmy Butler, Draymond Green side of the spectrum, MKG might be more on the Tony Allen side of the spectrum. So I don't know how that answers your question, Brian, but that's probably how I'm going to answer it for now.
Well, it's also that term disappointment, and I think so much of that has to do with context. One, context of your own subjective ideas to what you think is a success or not.
Right.
Also, the context of a high draft pick. You know, MKG was selected, what was it, second overall? Yeah. So that's something that's going to not necessarily dog him, because I think people have looked at him and recognized that he's got a great personality, that he has like his own issues, a well-documented speech impediment that was, you know, repaired through years and years of work, and a great piece from Lee Jenkins. I don't know if you remember that, where they kind of correlate. Yeah. Rebuilding his shot to the way he was able to rebuild his speech patterns. So, I mean, that was an interesting thing there. But with Winslow, I think the ceiling is probably higher, to be honest with you, than MKG and what we've seen. I think MKG is pretty clearly established. He's a cutter, a slasher, not a particularly good shooter, and a hell of a defender who's just going to sacrifice himself. We saw that when they played Miami. He's just throwing himself all over the court. That's just his style of play. It's led to a number of injuries. It's why he's been limited, you know, over the past couple of years the way he has been. He's just much more aggressive, I think, defensively. And not necessarily as sturdy as Winslow. He's certainly a bigger body type, I think. So,
a knack for getting points. He's been in the league for this is his fifth season,
right?
And in each of the last three seasons, he's scored in average double digit points despite bad shooting percentages,
right?
From 3-point range, and not so great shooting percentages just in general. You know, he gets to the line enough, but doesn't have a great free throw shooting percentage. But he's just one of those guys that just finds ways for tip-ins and putbacks or right. layups near the rim, just finds a way to get points. Almost like, I don't know, he offensively almost reminds me of like Taj Gibson. Just kind of like, how did you score 12 points tonight? Like, I don't even remember you scoring.
Mm.
So to me, I think you're right. I think Winslow definitely has a higher ceiling, and his expectations are almost different. Like Winslow... His expectations his first year with guys like Bosch and Dragic and Wade there, it was almost like, yeah, just go play defense and whatever points you get is just gravy, you know, that's great. But now with such a rebuilt roster, Winslow is being asked to almost be the guy, you know, or at least be the future guy. And so mm-hmm. now expectations have shifted, and you're seeing Winslow shift with those expectations, which I think has been promising. He's been aggressive, 3.7 attempts from 3-point range so far. Almost 15 attempts, shooting attempts per game compared to less than 6 last year. His usage rating has basically doubled. So as he's taken that new expectation, he's trying to meet those expectations. So we'll see how he progresses through this season.
So should we answer the question specifically, although there is different context and although we see their plateaus being different, even if we just compare what MKG is at this point to what Justice Winslow can be, would it be a disappointment? I'd have to say it would be if he's a playmaking version. We expect more of Winslow offensively to that point. So I think MKG is somewhat a little bit more limited. And I think that even if Michael Kidd-Gilchrist was more of an assist kind of guy, more of a facilitator, a playmaker, as Brian says, I still think that Winslow would be a little bit higher as far as his overall development is concerned.
Yeah, if he ends up just being an MKG who averages 3 assists per game, then yeah, that would be a disappointment. And that's not to disparage MKG. He's got a great place in the league, but that's at this point, for what the Heat need, that would be a disappointment from Winslow.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I see that a lot now as I continue covering the league and things of that sort. It's like, look, you know, not everybody's going to step on the floor and automatically be a superstar. You need to have role players. You need to be complementary. You need to have great fit across the roster, and that's fine. You know, it's about tempering your own expectations as fans. Also, you see guys who are top 10 picks all the time, and sometimes they just develop into 10 points per game guys that can defend fairly well or rebound fairly well or do, you know, something pretty well. And that's all about, you know, finding a niche and all that. And that's a good, you know, there's still only 450 guys in the NBA across the whole planet. And so I think even if you just make it on that point and not become a superstar, you're still pretty damn good. So
yeah, the Hornets have Kemba Walker to be their superstar, their main scorer, their alpha, so to speak, right?
Right.
They don't need, and having Kemba Walker in place and then having MKG in place allowed them to go out and sign a veteran like Al Jefferson, trade Noah Vonleh for a veteran like Nick Batum. Like, they're like, okay, this is what we got. Kemba Walker is like our guy who we're going to develop and who could possibly be a superstar in this league. MKG is what he is. He's our defensive stopper. Let's go get veterans to fill out this team. That's fine. But for the Heat, they're going to want and need more from Winslow. So yeah, that's why it would be a disappointment. Again, not to disparage MKG. I like MKG.
I do too.
Harold from Boynton Beach, where they have a Sonic that I used to go to all the time.
Nice.
When do you see 45-minute drive for Sonic? Yeah, I'd do it. When do you see the Heat taking Luke Babbitt out of the starting power forward position and using either Udonis Haslem or Derek Williams? So Harold's already he's out on Luke Babbitt already.
Which is interesting because I also saw some positive things from him against the Spurs. I mean, I think the shooting isn't quite as good as we'd like, but the defense was earnest. I mean, look, there are issues. As far as overall rotations, I talked about that in yesterday's podcast after the game. You know, he allowed a couple of perimeter shots there that shouldn't have happened if he had rotated properly on defense. But as far as whether or not how he fits into the rotation, I can tell you I don't think Udonis Haslem is ever going to start. I think he's more suited for the center position just because he's a little slower that can provide some offense, you know, for smaller lineups. And as far as Derek Williams, to me, I think the team's just not confident in his ability to take over a starting role. I think he's more duplicative of what James Johnson rather can do. And so if you go with either Williams or Johnson, they can give you pretty much the same thing. And neither of them can give you what Babbitt does, which is, you know, quality outside shooting.
Yeah, and Babbitt hasn't been bad this season. I mean, he's shooting 40% from 3-point range, 6 of 15 this season. It's been kind of bothersome that sometimes he'll try to drive to the basket rather than pass the ball. But the Heat, I've kind of given this more thought since getting this question in the mailbag, and the Heat can't just let him sit on the 3-point line and shoot. He's going to have to drive every once in a while. I don't think he should be driving as much because he has 21 Or am I reading this right? 21 field goal attempts and 15 three-pointers. So he should probably be taking more threes than just twos. But
wait, is that 21 total of 15 of which have been from three-point range?
Total. This is 21 total. So
he's not bad then.
Right. So he's taking more threes than twos, which is fine.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, he's only made 1 2-pointer, but he's missed a couple off the rim. Like, he's not his when he's driving, he's awkward, right? That's weird. It's not his game. He shouldn't be doing that, but he has to do some of that because otherwise he's just standing in the corner, and that becomes inefficient for ball movement at some point. We've seen it time over time where you just have guys that just stand, like the Pelicans last year, Ryan Anderson would just stand in the corner. At some point, you just knew, like, you don't have to cover him until he gets the ball because then you just close out. because he's not going to take you off the dribble. You know, you're not going to, if even if you're aggressive closing out, you still have to have the threat of taking an aggressive closeout off the dribble and going back, going around him. So it does hurt your spacing just as much if you're just a guy that just stands there. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. You know, we talked about that all season with the Levi's. Is it Levi's now? I can't remember who's sponsoring the Power Forward Bell at this point. We've had so many different sponsorship opportunities.
It's Supercuts now. I can't remember.
That's right. The Supercuts Power Forward Bell. brought to you by not just, you know, James Johnson's haircut, but also Luke Babbitt's floppy hair. That's it was two quality haircuts there. And not Eric to mention Williams. Derek Williams.
Yeah.
Each of them can certainly tie together something with Supercuts very easily. But yeah, it's a position of weakness. Look, the team went into the offseason thinking that they were going to get one of the best power forwards of all time to help them out at the four and play some minutes at the five. That wasn't the case. They got lucky and they were able to bring a guy like Willie Reed in there to back up Whiteside. But even that's been, you know, somewhat a position of weakness too, if you look at it from that perspective, as far as depth is concerned. But
I'm starting to think that the Heat's best option right now, and this is what we've seen at the end of the games, is Winslow at power forward. I do wonder if Josh Richardson, when he comes back, if you just play Dragic, Tyler Johnson as the starter, because we know he's a better shooting guard than point guard, right? Dragic, Tyler Johnson, Josh Richardson, Justice Winslow, and then Whiteside in the middle, and just play completely four out. That might be Miami's best lineup, because if Babbitt isn't working out in the long run, that might be the best case. But Babbitt's not been – he hasn't been that bad.
So then who comes in off of that? I guess, you know, so far we've seen a rotation that includes Magruder. I guess Dion would come off the bench. Maybe Babbitt. Maybe Ellington changes things up a little.
Ellington gets rotation minutes probably at that nominal small forward spot.
Right.
I mean, at that point, McRoberts, maybe he comes back. He can get some minutes at the four. Derek Williams. Like, you could still play Luke Babbitt off the bench. You could still play, give yourself a three-point shooter off the bench. You could still play Derek Williams and James Johnson off the bench. That's not a problem. It just might be a situation where you're almost playing the same rotations, but you're mixing up the rotations. Because, that's the team that they have. That's the lineup they have at the end of games. So you just take that end-of-game lineup, you move that to the beginning of the game as well, so you have the same two lineups in the start and the end of the game, and everything in the middle, you could still give Babbitt minutes of power forward, still give James Johnson minutes of power forward, that's fine, but maybe you just start small. That might not be the worst situation for Miami if they do indeed believe that Babbitt can't be the starting power forward.
Could you ever see Spoelstra going as many as like 12 deep in a rotation? Because that's what he'd have to do, right? Yeah. I mean, that's what we're talking about then. If he's going to bring...
I don't think so. Do you?
You don't think so? Yeah. What do you mean? Do I think he'd go 12 deep?
If by starting Winslow, does he have to go 12 deep?
By starting Winslow at the four? Yeah, I think so. Because then you have to bring in guys... Like, you can't just bring in... Okay, let's see. Okay, so you start Dragic, Richardson, Tyler Johnson, Winslow arguably at the four, and then Whiteside. So like Whiteside comes off the bench he goes to the bench pretty quickly. You bring in Willie Reed and maybe a guy like Dion to help spot some minutes there.
Yeah.
Then you get Magruder, and then all of a sudden you lose a lot of size and Winslow has to come off the bench. We've seen Winslow's aggressiveness lead to ticky-tack fouls. I mean, you're going to go early to James Johnson. I see Derek Williams kind
of the problem with Winslow playing the four is that now who guards the premier perimeter? Like, who guards Kawhi Leonard? Are you asking Josh Richardson at that point to guard Kawhi while Winslow has to guard a four? Like, you're almost wasting Justice Winslow's talents. Because he's not a guy who you want guarding power forwards, right?
That's a good point.
You want him guarding small forwards. So I don't know, man. I'm not sure I do like that starting lineup. Because then if the Heat are going to switch a lot of things in general, if they do go that small, they're going to switch basically everything.
Mm-hmm.
But Whiteside would obviously guard the opposing center, and then you're like, you can't just stick Winslow on Kawhi Leonard or Paul George or LeBron James. You can't do that in that situation, which is really where Winslow, I think, is really strong. I think that you take that away and you're almost left with Justice Winslow just kind of in this weird limbo.
Yeah, you're playing, let's say you play the Wizard, I mean the Golden State Warriors. You put Babbitt to guard Draymond? That seems like a massacre, right?
Yeah, maybe if you're playing the Warriors, you switch it up. That might be like a rare thing. But then if like you can't have anybody other than Justice Winslow guard Durant.
Exactly.
This is the question a lot of teams are worried about. Yeah. This is not unique to the Heat.
Right. I mean, Miami's not the only one at a disadvantage at this point. There's 29 other teams going, Jesus Christ, what the hell do we do now? So,
yeah, I don't think you do start Winslow at the four. And that was never Harold's question. He was wondering when do we start somebody like a real power forward over Luke Babbitt. I think Luke Babbitt will be the starter for a while. I do think the team works best with Babbitt as a starter for now, because he does provide enough spacing. He's gonna get hotter from 3-point range. Right now he's kind of hitting things like he has his moments. Like he'll hit two or three in a row and that's really how he gets that percentage up. If he just starts faster, that will be better for the team.
Oh sure.
But they're all like their concern isn't getting Luke Babbitt involved. Their concern is getting Justice Winslow involved, getting Goran Dragic involved, and more importantly getting Hassan Whiteside involved early. As this team comes together and the ball starts to move better, Babbitt will play better because he's in the rhythm of the offense, catch and shoot guy. And the offense hasn't looked super efficient and super smooth yet. And the better it gets, the more this team gels, the better Babbitt will be. At least I think. Hopefully.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't, then yeah, you give James Johnson and Derek Williams a shot. Or Josh McRoberts, who still can come back. Speaking of, George Coles asks, is there any way to salvage Josh McRoberts? Buyout, medical waiver, they clearly cannot trade him, and he's only getting older. Well, we've been asking this question for a while. Can the Heat get rid of McRoberts? And they can waive him, they could buy him out, maybe, but they're not going to do that. We've seen that. If they were going to do it, it was going to happen in the offseason in order to save Briante Weber or Beno Udrih from having to cut them. So they're not doing that. It's not worth the cost. He's making almost $6 million this season. They're not going to use a medical waiver on Josh McRoberts because that would require a representative, a doctor appointed by both the NBA and the NBAPA to be like, you can't play for the rest of your career. And his injuries, as continuous and as often as they are not that bad. They're not career-threatening injuries. He hurt his foot, you know? So I would disagree that they clearly can't trade him. I just, even though that they've reportedly tried in the past, I don't know that that's clear that they won't be able to do it at this trade deadline if they so wanted to. But I do think that the Heat's best case scenario might be their only option at this point is just to play McRoberts and see what happens. And with such a gap at power forward, like we were just talking about, maybe that's worth seeing what McRoberts could do for you.
Yeah, we did talk about that even before when we previewed the Charlotte Hornets game. You know, we talked with Chris Barnwell and everything that McRoberts had done for the Bobcats when he was with that team. And although spacing is an issue for Miami, maybe he spaces the floor in different ways, as you just alluded to. You know, he can pass, you know, he can create offense from the high post. And so as long as you have the right kind of team, and we've seen Winslow be a very capable slasher and cutter, even though he's very good at handling the ball and driving to the hoop as well. But maybe that's a role that he can continue to evolve into. And as long as you have a really great passer like McRoberts, who's constantly looking to get guys open and things of that sort, maybe you have a more free-flowing offense, even if it's not one that's as potent from the perimeter. And maybe that's something that's also helped out by having Josh Richardson in there. So maybe a revamped starting lineup in two weeks, let's say we can have as much of a revamped lineup of having Josh Richardson in there and McRoberts as well.
I like that lineup. Because if you're a team that's built around Hassan Whiteside, which they are right now, McRoberts is another guy who can get Whiteside the ball. Like, you can run a 4-5 pick and roll with McRoberts and Whiteside, which is insane. You can't do that with Luke Babbitt at the four right now. And I agree, once Josh Richardson comes back, you don't necessarily need Babbitt spacing from that position because now you have your best 3-point shooter probably in Richardson back on the floor.
Yeah, and he's much more capable of driving to the rim.
Right.
McRoberts is much more capable than Babbitt at this point. We've seen him, and even if he's not able to finish in traffic, he's a really good passer, and I think we'll see some really nice behind-the-back lobs or things along those lines, things that we've seen him do over the course of his career, if not necessarily during his stint with Miami. So that gives them a much better, much more dynamic offense, I think.
I love that idea. I think you're absolutely right. I think that's what's going to happen. I think you just nailed it. I think that once Richardson comes back, McRoberts hasn't played this season with his injury, so they might come back in the same, right around first, you know, they might come back in the same week within the same few games of each other. And the next thing you know, that could be Miami's starting lineup. I like that starting lineup, honestly. As long as McRoberts can stay healthy, I like that starting lineup. Because then you have enough.
That is the question, though.
Right, exactly. And you're at that point, you don't really need McRoberts to shoot all that much. You know,
right.
You're not asking them to come off the bench and help trigger a bench unit and get them started. You really want to just get Whiteside involved. Dragic is taking more shots. Winslow is taking twice as many shots as he did last year. So really, there's not going to be that many shots to go around for McRoberts in that starting group, which would be good for him. You just ask him to be the glue guy, which would be great.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, right? I'm trying to picture it, and it works on a lot of levels, you know, especially if Waiters isn't out on the floor. I think that would make things a little bit worse, just because he likes having the ball in his hands. But if you pitch it out to – if you have McRoberts kind of control the offense at the top of the key there, he can look to Whiteside if he gets open, or he can toss the lob. If he, you know, gets a defender who kind of jumps on him, if he kind of up fakes him into the air, he can drive past him and then look to a guy who's maybe spotting up from the perimeter, maybe on the short corner. There's a lot of different options there. If he draws a double team for some reason, then he'll probably likely have a guy like Winslow or Whiteside wide open at the rim. I mean, there's a lot of different opportunities there.
And a formation that we really haven't seen a lot of so far this year is the horn set that we know Spoelstra likes, because you have Babbitt at the four, who's not he's not big, nor is he a great passer. You know, he's not known for his passing, and he doesn't have that triple threat ability. Like, you're not worried about him putting the ball on the floor, and they've been using him a lot as for space on the floor. So you bring a guy like McRoberts in there, and all of a sudden we've seen Whiteside get the ball on the elbow and just do a dribble handoff or something, or even some nice bounce passes from there. You bring in a guy like McRoberts, that opens up a whole world of sets for the Heat to run.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if McRoberts is in the starting lineup eventually this season. I like that idea.
We'll see what happens.
That's our hope for Josh McRoberts. I'm very optimistic about that. If that happens, McRoberts is going to go from fan joke to fan favorite real quick, which would be a great turn for this season.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, that's all we have for today. Whether you were listening on iTunes, Google Play, Audioboom, TuneIn, or Stitcher, thank you for listening. Get in touch with the show on Twitter at LockedOnHeat or by email, where you can send us mailbag questions, comments, or sponsorship opportunities. That's LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. And if you aren't subscribed already, please do so to get the podcast automatically every day. Rate us, review us, say nice things about us, and thank you for sending in these mailbag questions. They were terrific as always. And we'll catch you next time.